Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report Mark McCandlish. Mark is a design illustrator who spent many decades working with the aeronautics industry and defense industry, and as a result has really made it a passion to study the technology that is being developed both in the black world as well as more broadly. And I had the opportunity to see his presentation at the Secret Space program and was very impressed. When they make the stream available, I hope if you have a chance, you'll take a look at his presentation. So, Mark, welcome to the Solari Report.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I'm delighted to be with you.
So tell us how you got interested in this area. It's a fascinating story.
Well, I've always been sort of a nuts and bolts kind of person. I've always enjoyed working on machines, understanding how they operate, how they go together, how they come apart. And I began drawing at an early age, and I just sort of combined the two things. One, in helping myself to understand how things go together diagrammatically, and also being able to develop new machines, new ideas, new concepts. I think I would say that I'm more of a conceptual artist than a designer, because I would work from the blueprints and the diagrams provided to me by the clients in the aerospace industry to come up with images, artwork that I would create with paint and brushes and sort of the old-fashioned way, if you will, that would help them to promote or to depict the ideas of new systems that they were developing or hadn't even been built yet. And this was one of the ways that they would help to solicit funding from various appropriations committees within the Congress and the Senate in order to build some of the weapon systems that were defending the United States. So as far as the interest side on, you know, these unusual technologies, my dad was the non-commissioned officer in charge, or NCOIC, at the base dental lab at Westover Air Force Base in the 60s, which was a strategic air command, a SAC base in Massachusetts near the city of Chicopee. And we had live nuclear weapons on the base. We had B-52s cycling through the base every 12 hours or so. And so there was always, you know, with the Cold War being what it was, and in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the unfortunate death of President Kennedy, so there was a constant din of jet engines at the base. And we had, if you look at Westover Air Force Base or the remains of the base on Google Earth, you can actually see a section of the old runway where there is a little tributary runway that comes off at one end. I believe it's the I think it may be the north end of the runway system, where there's a kind of a herringbone pattern. And this is a place where they would park a flight of loaded B-52s that were armed and ready to go at a moment's notice. And it was in 1966, in the winter of that year, I believe it was, that I actually saw a UFO hovering over the alert aircraft that were loaded with nuclear weapons, and watched it through a telescope for about 10 minutes, and then suddenly it began to drift away and then accelerated at an astonishing rate and disappeared in just a couple of seconds.
Was that the first time you'd ever seen one?
Yes, in fact, it was, but it's not the first time someone in my family had seen one. When my dad was stationed before that over at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, my younger brother had seen one moving in and out of the clouds, almost as if it were playing a game of peekaboo with my brother. He would look up, see it, and it would dart back behind the clouds, and then he'd go back to what he was doing, and he'd look up again, and there would be open in the open again, and as soon as he would look up, it would hide behind the cloud again. And that happened for the better part of a half an hour, and it wasn't until later we had found out about it that he was rather surprised by what was happening. So, you know, but
it's astonishing the number of sightings. Dr. Farrell did a good job, I thought, at the conference of introducing the topic of the, you know, the tremendous interest UFOs seem to have in the nuclear weapons and nuclear activities.
Well, you know, I've always wondered if there's some other aspect of a nuclear detonation that affects space-time in a way that maybe we haven't learned to appreciate yet, that maybe that, you know, when you are talking about Einstein's equation E equals mc squared, that that there's actually a time element that's in that equation. The speed of light squared, of course, indicates, you know, the photons moving at the rate of, you know, 186,000 miles per second squared, or times itself. So it's a tremendous velocity. And so I have a feeling that somewhere in the equation there's a, you know, a factor that has to do with time, or, you know, the multidimensionality of space-time in such a way that it sends out a ripples of disturbance through the continuum that brings a you know, a bit of notice back to us in our particular location in that environment. So, I think that
now you've had many sightings over the years.
It's really surprising to me. I mean, I have to say that one of the strangest aspects of this was that I had that sighting, a very dramatic sighting, you know, on a SAC base. When I was, I guess, probably about 12 or 13 years old, and then within just a few years had completely forgotten it. In fact, through most of my young adulthood, lamented the fact that many of my friends had seen these things, but I had never had a sighting myself, when, in fact, I had. And it wasn't until I was, I went to a lady, Yvonne Smith, and I went through one of those hypnotic regressions. That and the only reason I did is because when my parents sold the house that they'd lived in for many years, they found a document, an essay that I'd written shortly after the sighting, completely describing everything that had happened there. And I couldn't remember any of it. And so I had her hypnotic.
You probably ran into the Men in Black neuralizer.
Well, you know, that's really, yeah. I mean, I know it sounds rather bizarre, but after she was able to take me back and help me to visualize what happens in such an effective way that I was actually re-experiencing the extreme cold on the evening, to the point where I was laying on this couch under hypnosis with my teeth chattering because I was re-experiencing the cold, you know, in a completely comfortable, normal living room. Here I am laying there with my teeth chattering because I'm experiencing the cold again. But what also came back to me was an encounter that I had with the base commander's son when I had left the classroom momentarily to use the facilities. And as I was coming back, there was this intersection in the structure of the school called Four Corners, where two different long hallways met at right angles. And there, standing in the middle of it under the skylight, was the base commander's son, who was a very imposing young man. He's much he was very tall for his age. And that's the last time I remember anything about that. That sighting and what had happened. So it does have that kind of an implication. It's really strange. But, you know, after 1988, when there were indications from one of my colleagues that I'd gone to college with, who had seen a number of vehicles using some of this advanced technology propulsion in a hangar at Palmdale, at Air Force Plant 42 at the Skunk Works facility. That was when I realized that this wasn't just someone's fantasy or science fiction, you know, an active imagination, but it was real life technology that they figured out how to make it work. And the interesting thing about this was that the individual was able to describe the components and how they worked. And up until that moment in time, I'd had a correspondence with the retired Army Colonel Thomas Bearden, trying to understand the so-called zero-point energy. And it was an energy that they were describing that existed even down beyond the point where you completely quieted all the so-called Brownian or molecular vibrations from heat, the Brownian motion. And so here was this charge that remained in the material, even to a point where it was almost down to what was called absolute zero, and that's sort of where the name came from, quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum. And so,
and why, tell us why zero-point energy is so important.
Well, for me, my understanding of this particular type of energy form is it's pervasive, and it's there's an extremely high energy density embedded in the vacuum of space-time. Imagine the energy that is all around us from the various TV and radio stations, radar, different transmissions that are passing through our bodies and through the environment all the time, and we never perceive any of this. And yet, if you have a radio that can be tuned to the right frequency, you can hear music and people talking and this kind of thing. Well, the energy density is so high that if you were able to actually tap into all of it, now they're saying that it's something approaching 10 to the 109th power joules per cubic centimeter. It's a number that's so high that you might actually be able to find enough energy in a cubic foot of space-time to boil off all of the oceans of the entire planet. This is one of the reasons why it's probably so classified and why it's so dangerous, because as a weaponized type of system, it could be extremely dangerous. I mean, far more dangerous than a nuclear weapon. But yeah. The reason why it's important is that if you look at a number of the papers that have been written in Physics Review and other publications of the American Physical Society and the international community, you find that this energy is really the underlying cause for things like the effect of mass or inertia. When you're driving your car, you suddenly turn the wheel to avoid somebody's cat that's run out into the roadway. Your body tends to want to continue going in the same direction. So the car rolls a little bit to one side or the other. As you turn the wheel, you feel your body moving around. It's also the cause of G-forces that are experienced by pilots when they're flying these high-performance jets. And the faster you move along, the more powerful the effect is. And, of course, it's all driven by another process that has been talked about by Einstein in general relativity and other of his equations, having to do with inertia and the increase in mass as you accelerate through space-time, as you move more quickly through space-time. This force, the G-forces that you experience become more powerful as you begin to change direction. Now, part of the reason for this is that even in high school, you know, we talked about the laws of thermodynamics and how, you know, if you toss a football or a soccer ball, you kick it across the field, that it'll bounce and eventually slow down and stop. And this has become because of frictional losses in the environment, the so-called second law of thermodynamics is the law of entropy, where you dissipate the energy into the environment. But when you get down to the atomic scale, when you get down to the very structure of the atom, the neutrons and the protons that are in the nucleus of the atom, and the electrons that are spinning around it in the different shells, different energy levels within the structure of the atom, you find that there doesn't seem to be any process where entropy comes into play at all. There's no slowing down. These particles are always in motion, continuously. So in a way, the structure of the atom itself is literally the perfect model of a perpetual motion machine, if you will. And so after a while, the question becomes, well, what is it that keeps these particles in constant movement? Why do they never lose any energy? Why are they seemingly in violation of the law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics? And it's because they're constantly being replenished by absorption of this zero-point energy from the environment. And that is why, as you accelerate through space-time, as Einstein was postulating in describing the inability to ever reach the speed of light itself, was as you accelerate through space-time, the interaction or the absorption of this energy from the environment by every atom in your body and the vehicle that you're riding in, it causes the subatomic particles in the structure of the atom to become more and more energized. And I imagine that at some level they either spin more quickly or the internal nuclear forces become so strong that the effect of mass increases, and it goes up exponentially as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, to the point where as you're nearing the speed of light, it becomes near infinite, according to Einstein. And so it's this energy that these propulsion systems are actually exploiting. And so what you're doing is you're standing just about everything that Einstein said on its head. And by that I mean that if you're able to tap into this energy form that's responsible for the increase in mass, you're actually able to sort of reverse it almost in an inversely proportional kind of way, so that the faster you go, the more energy you have available to use to continue your acceleration onward. And at the same time, it seems to be that you're diminishing the effect of mass. I mean, if you fire a bullet, it has an increased mass, something that is probably measurable. But then as it begins to slow down, that energy is dissipated back into the environment so that it returns to its what you might call its steady state mass. And the same is true for these propulsion systems. They're able to exploit this particular energy in the environment to and put it to useful work for propelling the craft. But at the same time, it seems to be diminishing this effect of increased mass. And so making these dramatic right-angle turns at 9,000 miles through per hour through the environment to be able to stop on a dime and do all of these things without what you might suppose are the G-forces killing the pilots inside the vehicle, it's really something to behold. I've seen it on a number of occasions. And it becomes clear almost immediately that whatever the technology is, it seems to be in violation of everything we know of in terms of physics.
Right. So it's fair to say that what we're operating with in terms of our notion of physics is a very limited picture, if not just dead wrong.
What the public is aware of, it certainly is.
Right.
But in the physics community, we're starting to see that there are other things going on within the structure of space-time, particularly when it comes to the application of certain material sciences that really seem to defy reality. For example, some of the high-temperature superconducting materials like yttrium, barium, copper oxide. You can take a sapphire wafer and wrap it in plastic, dip it in a liquid nitrogen solution, and then place it anywhere near a magnetic field that it will essentially pin itself in space-time so that its relationship to that magnetic field remains fixed, and it'll float at a particular angle and move along a track of magnets that are adhered to a steel base, and it will never change its orientation to that field. You can even suspend it below this track. You can see videos of this on the internet very, very quickly, just doing a search of high-temperature superconducting materials. But this shows that you can create situations in which some of the rules seem to be broken. In fact, there have been experiments done with firing a laser beam through a chamber with a special type of cesium gas, and they measure the speed of light as being somewhere between 3 and 100 times faster than the normal speed of light. They've also found that if you take a pair of charged capacitor plates, place them into a chamber that's been evacuated of all gases like, you know, the air or oxygen or any of those gases we find in the air that we breathe, and that you could see as much as 3 times the normal speed of light as a laser beam passes between these two charged plates. And so all of this comes into play in these propulsion systems and the design that they use. And there's, just like in cars, there's probably a dozen different ways in which you can achieve these effects. Some are more powerful than others. Some actually seem to produce a kind of time dilation effect. There's a scientist that I used to know some years ago, who's passed away now, Dr. Fred Bell, who lived in down near Laguna Beach, I believe it was, who had developed a type of apparatus that you could sit inside of, and it looked like kind of like a polyhedron. Imagine all the little pentagonal shapes on a soccer ball, fashioned out of flat plate surfaces that are all interlocked with one another. And each of those particular plates is actually a stack of parallel plate capacitors that are all sort of sandwiched together with a strong dielectric or insulating material in between. He had a sort of a column inside with a series of electromagnets and lasers that would operate all at the same time. And he was able to, from the interior of this device that he built, was able to observe a difference in the rate of time or the flow of time from a vantage point inside this apparatus. And namely, he would turn this thing on at night and sit inside of it, and he could watch the cars passing on the road behind his house go from, 45 or 50 miles an hour to a snail's pace at a flip of a switch. And, in fact, they would slow down so much that the periodic flashing on and off of the headlights because of the alternator in the system would cause the headlights to slowly go out and slowly come back on again in these sort of flashing intervals. So he was slowing his own experience of time down to something that would compress, say 5 minutes of living into about a tenth of a second. And, I'm not sure whether the side effects on one's health are something that you want to be concerned about, but I imagine that is possible. But he clearly showed the ability to modify time as well as his experience of space and time while in this environment. And in fact, it was in 1994 that Miguel Alcubierre, who was working at the University of Wales in the UK at the campus on Cardiff, who proposed that it was possible to create a space warp kind of propulsion system without violating general relativity. And by that he meant that you could create a device that would cause a kind of polarity or polarization process to occur where you could expand space-time behind your line of travel and compress space-time. Think of it as being similar to having a supernova going off behind you and a black hole in front of you. And these were distortions of space-time that could be created by the system that you were employing to propel the craft. And so now in his proposal he was talking about using dark matter, but in my sort of visualization or conceptualizing of that process, using something a little bit more contemporary, you could use this zero-point energy because of the high energy density. It would fit all of the requirements for what he was proposing. But essentially you pin the rate of space, the rate of time, and the other spatial relationships, including the effect of gravity, within a space-time bubble, or what is called a dynamically engineered local space-time. And then you impart forces to the surrounding space-time that actually can push you through the environment at what he called arbitrarily high speeds, and by that he meant faster than the speed of light, because essentially you're propelling or moving a chunk of space-time, which is essentially considered to be a placeholder, kind of a pocket of nothing, if you will. You just happen to be sitting in that space-time as it's being moved along by forces outside the local environment.
You described a sighting when you were talking at the conference where essentially there was nighttime in front, but it was leaving a trail of daytime.
Well, that was one of the side effects that I've noticed over the years. Up here in Northern California, we have a tremendous amount of activity of these vehicles. I think that in some areas, particularly northeast of the city of Cedarville, which is in the northeastern corner of California along the Nevada border, there appears to be an awful lot of flight testing that goes on out in these areas. And I think they've carried it away from the Nevada test site and Area 51 and that kind of thing, because the activity seems to be so pervasive. There are people in the mountains to the west of Redding that actually have weekly UFO parties or sighting parties, where they see things fairly often. And in fact, it's an awful lot like what Ed Grimsley has been doing, using the thermal imaging and night vision goggles to look at the sky and watch the activity. And I mean, I've literally had half a dozen sightings right out of my own backyard just by looking in the right direction. And one of the peculiar things about that was that it seems to adhere to a very precise military schedule, where I noticed that there was the same kind of activity happening at precisely the same moment on the precisely the same evening certain times of the week. And usually it was late Wednesday night, early Thursday morning at 2:22 a.m. You would see the same object descend from the sky, coming out of a sort of a wormhole, if you will, and then descend behind the distant mountains. Now, getting back to what you're talking about was the what I call image dragging effect that occurs when you see one of these wormhole events occur. The very first time I saw this...
Mark, can I just stop you for a second? Can you explain what a wormhole is?
Well, I think it was one of Einstein's colleagues got together with him, and they proposed what was called the Einstein-Rosen bridge, which was a folding of space-time. Imagine that you, instead of traveling physically between two points in space and time, that you're actually able to fold space and time, like taking a paper towel or a sheet off your bed, and you're taking the two corners opposite one another, and you bring them together, imagining space-time as a kind of almost like a manifold, where it folds into a kind of a tube that is then able to connect two distant points instantaneously. So rather than physically traveling between, say, here and the moon, you simply fold space-time so that they at least appear to be immediately proximate to one another. So what you're doing then is you're connecting two moments in space and time through a distortion of space-time that you create with the propulsion system. Now, several examples that I've seen myself or I've had recounted to me, probably the most dramatic of which was by a fellow who'd been a navigator on a B-52 during the Vietnam War, coming back from Guam, traveling towards Southeast Asia. Late at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, full moon over the ocean, no clouds anywhere in sight. They're suddenly being shadowed by a disk that they estimated conservatively between a half a mile, a quarter of a mile, and a half a mile in diameter. And I asked the gentleman, who was quite elderly, how did you ascertain the size of this thing? He says, well, there was an illuminated translucent dome at the center on the top of this thing. And he said you could actually see the different stories, the different floors inside this sort of semi-transparent dome. And he said we counted 27 stories.
Good Lord.
Yes. But he said that this thing had some kind of a cooling ventilation system, a series of giant turbine blades around the edges that seemed to circulate air into the body of the vehicle to cool down whatever the propulsion system was doing because of the tremendous amount of energy it was using. And he said that each of these turbine blades was the size of a hangar bypass door, and that right before this thing accelerated out of sight, these turbine blades were rotating around the perimeter of this craft at such a high rate you could not even see them. They all became blurs. Now, he said that the craft moved away from their B-52 a short distance and then suddenly accelerated off at an oblique angle, and he indicated that in its wake, now remember, this is 1 o'clock in the morning in a black night sky with only stars and a full moon reflecting off the ocean, but he said that this thing left in its wake a shimmering trail of light, and through this sort of tunnel that it created in space-time, he says you could see a day-lit sky with puffy white clouds, and it was almost as though this huge craft came out of a tunnel into the sunlight as it emerged somewhere else, presumably around on the sunlit side of the Earth, and emerged from this kind of a wormhole event where it had literally connected, in a straight line direction, so to speak. In other words, if it had continued in the direction it was going, it would go right out into space. So it was obviously connecting to a place and time around. I mean, if you curve the Earth, you go around to the other side where the sun is shining. So it's not even a direct line of sight connection. It's in another place, another time on the same planet, but around where the sun is shining. Now, that was one example. The very first occasion when I had a sighting of this sort of an event occurring was coming back from an Angels baseball game, traveling on Interstate Route 91 through or near Carbon Canyon in Southern California. And this was southwest of the community of Chino, where the old recycling center for World War II planes was after the war, Second World War. But this event started with a brilliant flash of light in the sky, and then from what appeared to be an opening in the sky, a glowing white sphere of light, sort of fuzzy on the edges, came slowly descending out of this opening in the sky, and became progressively larger as it descended beyond the distant hills, about a 45-degree angle of declination. And this object had streaming behind it, moving in unison with it, the same rate, were a series of parallel lines that were all exactly equal in length, staggered in their position, and slightly different in line weight. Some lines were thin and faint, and some lines were wider and very bright. And it took me a while to figure out what it was exactly that I'd seen. But if you remember in the very first George Lucas Star Wars film, where they make the so-called jump to light speed, and all the stars in the distance become streaks of light,
well, right.
Apparently, that turns out to be a very real effect of what you would perceive as you go through a wormhole, except in the instance of actually moving out of one of these events, you know, emerging at the far end, so to speak, it drags along the imagery of the location in space-time where this particular event was initiated. And so in many instances, it appears that these objects are often coming from a distant star system. And so they're pointed directly away from the star at the center of the system where they're leaving. And when they do, that brilliant flash that you see in the very beginning is the last glimmer of starlight from the star that they are departing from to come to this particular location. And so what I was seeing in that instance was the images of the stars that would have been seen in the background behind this object if it had departed from a place deep in space and away from a star. And it was literally dragging the images of those stars along with it. In fact, all the stars had kind of a goldish-yellow cast to them, which I believe would be attributable to kind of a redshift in the frequency of the light as the craft moved at an extremely high speed away from those stars.
Now, it's interesting. I was talking on a radio show a while back, and what I said was, you know, if you look at the number of sightings that have occurred over the last, say, since World War II, you know, we're talking about hundreds of trillions of dollars of hardware if you tried to cost it out. Okay. So I was just coming at it from an economic side, and then a subscriber wrote in and said, well, you know, most of them are holograms.
Well, you know, I mean, I certainly believe that producing large-scale holograms is possible, because I've actually had accounts related to me where people near Kirtland Air Force Base down in the community of Albuquerque, New Mexico, have actually seen disc-shaped vehicles emerging from the side of a mountain in a canyon near their home, and that there's a kind of a shimmering, sort of a wavering in the image, almost as though you're looking at an image that's been printed on a very large sheet of material, and that there are these ripples that sort of move across the image, and then suddenly, almost like a fish jumping out of water, the craft comes physically right out of the side of the mountain, and then the image of the mountain sort of reasserts itself and goes back to sort of a non-wavering kind of form, almost as though the image that one might see of the mountainside there, you know, it may actually be a kind of opening to a kind of garage or a sort of a tunnel, if you will, coming up from something that's underground, and that visually, it appears to be a normal hillside or a cliff. You know, so it's, unless you're actually trying to climb up there and see what it is, it has all the appearances of being the side of a cliff or a mountain. So I think producing holograms is a possibility. There were papers published back in the early 1980s of actually being able to create images by projecting a certain kind of laser light up into and causing the ionization left by micrometeorites in the atmosphere, causing that those ionized particles to fluoresce even to the point where they could produce different colors. And it turns out that there are a number of studies that have been done with certain materials in nanoparticle form. And this is where a lot of people try to connect the whole chemtrailing geoengineering subject to UFOs. But it's possible to actually put particles in the sky that are so small that, I mean, you could line 40 of these little tiny spheres up next to a single red blood cell. That's how tiny these things are. And they actually resonate at microwave frequencies. And there are certain materials that if suspended in the air and bombarded with right frequency of microwave radiation will actually change color. And so if you put enough of this kind of material up in the air and you know what the exact size of the particles are, you can get different areas of the sky to react and luminesce, if you will, or fluoresce in particular colors. And so if you have a beam that's modulated in such a way that it produces a kind of an image, just like, you know, the sort of the scan that occurs each time your television set flashes, you know, an image on and off so quickly you don't actually perceive the changes, that yes, you could produce holographic images in the sky. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, every physical sighting or, you know, that every vehicle that people are seeing is just a projection, because you'd have to have line of sight projection from a laser that could produce that. And usually these systems require multiple laser transmissions in order to pull it off. So, to have something move from one end of the sky to the other at speeds that are impossibly high. I mean, you know, and to do all of this without a sonic boom, supersonic shockwave. Something else I can explain also if you're interested. But
you know what I'd love you to do is, I did not realize the possibility of looking at a lot of these craft through night goggles. So I would love it if you would describe that phenomena, because I'm about to order a pair.
Well, the principle is that they found a way through electronics to there is a kind of material that they use in a sort of grating that's on the inside of the optics of these systems, and this grid, if you will, is energized with the battery power of the power system in the optics. And what it does is it amplifies light in the ones that are used for night vision. You have a single photon come in, and it strikes this matrix of material, and it produces a reaction that cascades through the material, and it actually produces, multiple photons that are stimulated or kicked out of their basically it's like an ionization process where the atoms of this material kick out additional photons, so in effect you have kind of a snowballing effect of the number of photons produced from the impact of a single photon in this material. And so anytime you have a light image, something that can be focused, you know, with the varying degrees of light and dark and shading over the course of the image area itself, you can produce an amplification of the light that's coming from a source. Some of the systems that they have now, there was a fellow at the conference who may have met him, Nick Ellis, very, very intellectual young man, very into the optics, was explaining some of these things to me. And he had one that had a lens cap over it, and he said, take a look. And I could actually see in a dark room with the lens cap, where he says there's a little tiny pinhole in the very center of this thing. And he says the amplification of light is so intense that this thing is simultaneously acting like a pinhole camera, but it's also amplifying just the minimal amount of light that's coming through that pinhole that you can see clearly as though the lens cap isn't even on the optics at all. And so by being able to amplify the very small amounts of light that are produced by these vehicles being moved through the atmosphere or above the atmosphere in space, that you can actually perceive their movements much more clearly by this amplification process. And that's what Ed Grimsley does. It's what there's a fellow up in Oregon somewhere, Gellinan, or I can't remember his last name. But anyway, there are a number of people who are making these discoveries, and in fact, there was Ed Grimsley, who was at the conference, who had a number of these units that he was allowing people to use to see these things for himself, and they're happening all the time, practically anywhere you look in the sky. There's all kinds of activity, and this isn't just amplifying the ionization path of micrometeorites, but these are actually physical vehicles that are moving around above the Earth in space. And in many instances, it appears to be a kind of war going on out in space, with beams of light being shined at one another. And I've even heard people report of what appeared to be the destruction of some of the vehicles that were in these battles. So.
Right.
It's kind of a startling perception that might be happening and no one knows, but
well, I wouldn't say no one knows, but it's a surprising amount of the population. A surprising number of us are sort of going about our business and not noticing this is going on. And it's kind of, you know, it's interesting to know you can pull out a pair of night goggles and look up and see it.
Well,
it's there.
And that's just scratching the surface. I mean, just in the last year, I and another person that I was with on the 12th of July last year, just after the sun had set, it was about 9:10 in the evening, we were just looking at the beautiful clear sky, no clouds or anything, and there was this kind of distortion of the image of the clear, smooth, you know, deep blue sky. And then there was a glimmer of light. And being an artist and having studied, you know, the way reflections work across the surfaces of, you know, shiny, you know, automobiles or even the canopy of a, you know, a fighter craft or a fighter aircraft, I have learned to read what those reflections say about the shape of these things. And so I realized what I was looking at was what appeared to be a giant glass cylinder, something larger than an aircraft carrier, probably between 12 and 15,000 feet, maybe as high as 17,000 feet. And of course, the higher this thing might have been, it had to be even larger, because this thing had kind of a hemisphere shape at each end of the cylinder, and it was rotating in a horizontal plane, sort of, well, from my perspective, in a counterclockwise kind of direction. But as it did so, the sunlight, which was coming from below the horizon behind me, was glinting off the smooth surface of this vehicle, which appeared to be using some kind of optical stealth system. It was really startling to behold, because I could see the reflection of the sun streaming down the cylindrical side of this thing, and then when the sort of sphere-shaped and came around and was pointed in my direction, there was a big, because of that convex surface, there was this tremendous flare of sunlight at the one end, and I pointed it out to the person I was with. I said, look at that. And no sooner had we both looked up at it, this thing took off like a shot going east and was out of sight in just about a second and a half. It was really startling, because here was an object that was exploiting some light bending ability, and you can find videos of this technology or the early attempts at perfecting the technology right online. There's even a video that was recorded over in Afghanistan a few years ago of an M1 Abrams tank coming through an opening in a wall on a patrol. It was the first in a column of vehicles. And it hits a landmine, and its treads are destroyed, and it comes to a stop. Another M1 comes up behind it and stops as the video is rolling. along with some Humvees and some other vehicles, armored vehicles behind that. And as the soldiers come out and begin to deploy, you see this blurry image sort of moving across the scene from right to left. And as it crosses in front of the tank that has come to stop, the second one in the column, you see the sort of distorted silhouette of a man in uniform running up to the tank, stepping up on the treads and climbing up and laying down on the turret. In fact, I think a couple of search terms you can look for, aside from invisibility suit or something like that, is the phrase kit up, KIT-UP. And you can see this video, and it seems apparent then that there is some kind of covering that some of our special forces people are able to wear, which sort of lends a whole new meaning to the term ghost, which they like to call themselves. But it literally hide in plain sight by bending light around yourself. And it's really remarkable. But apparently they've actually perfected the technology so that they can put this on large vehicles that are exploiting these exotic propulsion systems, and they can hover in plain sight and you'll never see them. There's been a lot of controversy about the subject of drones flying around and watching us without our knowledge. And in fact, I have a very powerful pair of Barska binoculars, 20 by 80 fixed focal length, and was watching some police activity near my home. There was a helicopter hovering nearby, and I saw what looked like the pilot or one of the men in the helicopter, the police helicopter, open the door and step out onto one of the skids, and he was looking below and behind his helicopter. I thought, what on earth is this guy doing? And as I looked in my binoculars, I saw this what looked like a mirrored ball, smooth sphere, not the kind that you see at the discos, you know, with all the individual flat little plates that reflect the lights, but this was looked like a ball of glass that was floating up and behind the helicopter. He's looking back around the corner, watching this thing. And it hovered up into a point above and behind the helicopter, and then it stopped on a dime, and it just sat there. And I swear to God, Catherine, this thing looked like it had a camera lens sticking out of the side of this thing, and it was watching the police activity on the ground. And the pilot just, he looked like he'd seen a ghost. But with the naked eye, you could not see this thing. It was probably hovering at 600 or 700 feet above the ground. It didn't appear to be much more than 2 or 3 feet in diameter. And yet, to the naked eye from, less than a quarter of a mile, maybe an eighth of a mile away, I could not see this thing with the naked eye.
Right.
And so, that was very disturbing to me.
What I saw, when I started driving around the country in the 90s, what I realized, what it looked to me was you had surveillance satellites, low level, and they would skip back and forth so that you couldn't, but you could see them. And literally you had surveillance satellites sort of watching every local area all around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But I'll never forget. The only sighting I've ever had is I was driving across the Dakotas. I was driving across the Dakotas, I think it was 2005, and there was literally, it was very late at night, it's say 3 a.m, there was literally hundreds and hundreds of UFOs hanging in the sky. It was like an RV park for UFOs. I thought,
it was South Dakota?
Yeah, and it looked like an invasion, except they're all just hanging there, and you thought, it was very spooky because I didn't have a CB radio. I wanted to, talk to somebody else.
Sure.
Because I thought, did they just send them all up here so that no one would notice, because it's not well populated. What is this?
Yeah.
But when it's when you see that kind of tech.
North Dakota is a strategic, it used to be a strategic air command base. I think they call it air combat command these days.
It was just like a parking lot. Everybody just sort of hanging there. And
but you're sure that these weren't just stars and that you were having...
Yeah, they had different colored lights and they were too low. They were too low in the sky and they had different lights. And, the ones that were closest, you could see something. I mean, it was a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's possible that some of them at the higher levels could have been stars, but it was just, you know, it was a lot of them. And some of them were pretty big.
Well, I would have been tempted to stop and observe for a while, but I suppose when there's that many of them, it's a little frightening.
Well, it was just, you know, I wasn't so much frightening as the and I'm sure you've felt this, when you know, what they speak to is a reality. Because one of the things you can presume from looking at them is they're not running on fossil fuel. That's number one. So you're talking about energy and propulsion and anti-gravity technologies, which are way beyond anything that is supposed to exist.
That's
and
true.
And that has
ridicule anyone who says that they've seen these things in action,
right?
Because it sounds like something right out of a science fiction story. You know?
Well, but you know what I deal with in the financial area is there's reality and then there's official reality, and they just keep getting further apart. And
I remember your presentation. It was fascinating to listen to your experiences and how you were able to determine just how little accountability there seems to be for how money is moved around within governments and around the world. It really makes you wonder where your money's going as a taxpayer.
Well, I know where it's going. I think it's going into building these ships,
you know.
We
had an exchange in an email earlier about this, and I think that, you know, the huge numbers that we see in terms of, you know, trillions of dollars, $2.3 trillion, I think, was one of the observations by Donald Rumsfeld in June or July of 2001. But I don't think that it's devoted entirely just to creating these advanced technologies or actually building deployable systems, if you will. I think that a lot of the expense probably goes into the building of these underground facilities.
Yes.
That are responsible for housing and hiding them when they're not actually flying around.
Right. So you have a network of underground facilities and underground transportation facilities, because
mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, you basically got an underground network. You've got a parallel universe underground. And that's very expensive to not just build, but to maintain. You're talking about maintaining an entire civilization and operating it and maintaining it. So whether it's the facilities, the, you know, the industrial capacity, the transportation, that's very expensive. And then, of course, building them and flying them around and, you know, whatever we're doing out there in space. So I think, you know, you're talking about a very, very expensive endeavor. And it's the only if you look at the amount of money that's being harvested out of the financial system in a variety of ways, and including the governmental ways, it's the only sort of asset in operation I can identify which matches the level of money that's going missing.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, one of the more striking examples that I've come across was shared with me by one of the other speakers at our conference, Michael Schratt, who had interviewed an individual who had been involved in the movement of large vehicles through these tunnels as part of that system between Air Force Plant 42 in Palmdale, where Lockheed Skunk Works is located, and Edwards Air Force Base, which is located to the north and east of that facility. And he said that this gentleman described a tunnel with kind of an arching ceiling, all cement, underground, you know, many stories underground. And he said that this tunnel itself was wide enough that you could have two B-52 strategic bombers pass one another wingtip to wingtip and have several feet left over as they were being towed along through this tunnel. Now,
that's expensive.
Well, yeah, that is not only expensive, but it's a very serious feat of engineering, not only to create a tunnel like that, but then to line it with cement to strengthen and prevent the, you know, the ceiling from crumbling and falling, especially in an area that's known for its, you know, incredible seismic activity, you know, the Palmdale Bulge and all the rest of it.
Right.
But there, one of the other things that I've come across, and this is true in the case of this what appears to be a secret facility, underground facility, on the eastern margins of Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico, the Northrop radar cross-section testing facility south southeast of Mojave and north, southwest of Mojave and northwest of Palmdale, which is known to go down at least 23 stories below the surface, is that every one of these facilities, you can find several things that local landmarks, if you will, that they have in common. One is an unusual and unique or isolated power supply, like a big windmill farm, which, of course, is all across the Tehachapi Mountains in that region. You'll also find a reservoir or some source of fresh water and lots of it. But in almost every single instance where these sightings suggest that there is something going on underground, you'll also find either a gravel pit or a cement operation. Very often, under the control of the California Portland Cement Company. So this is also true for Kirtland Air Force Base. If you look at Google Earth, you can see a cement factory to the east of that going out towards the community of Moriarty, which is up on kind of a plateau above where the base is located. And that's also where this individual saw one of these discs emerging from the side of a cliff that shimmered like a hologram as it was emerging. So,
Mark, let me just talk a little bit about the fact, so from what I see as a financial matter, is you have the American taxpayer or different taxpayers, it's really around the world at this point because of the way the treasury system works, who are paying for these kinds of facilities and the development of these kinds of technologies, and yet they're not getting the financial benefit of them. And it's clear that whoever has these kind of technologies has enormous political and military leverage.
I agree with you more. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I sometimes look at the way people are voting in the Congress and the Senate, and in many instances it almost seems as though they're voting against their own party's line, and you wonder why that happens. Like the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts voting against the taxpayer and saying that Obamacare is perfectly okay and it's just another tax, when all the indications were that the idea of forcing the individual citizen into some kind of a commercial endeavor was unconstitutional. And so you really start to wonder whether or not it even goes even deeper than that, and where the government itself sees us as entities that are of a subject status rather than sovereigns,
right.
The founding fathers thought we should be. But I think you're absolutely right that the technology is so frightening. I mean, I have actually been told by one scientist in particular that the technology is so powerful and can be so finely applied that just by simply using a high-resolution photograph of an individual, that this technology can detect the precise location of the person in the photograph, wherever they happen to be in space and time, on the Earth or somewhere else. I believe he called it the Hieronymus effect. But this is essentially treating the photograph itself as kind of a holographic record of a moment in time where, photons were either being absorbed and re-emitted by the surface of the person's skin, and through quantum entanglement, you're able to take and sort of track down the photons that were there and then at that moment, and then extrapolate where those same atoms that make up the person's body are at a present moment in space and time. It's really spooky. But this is, of course, magnified by the fact that just about everybody has their own cell phone with its own particular signature. I mean, I literally think that, the only way you could really completely disappear in our society today is to just never carry a cell phone or any kind of an iPad with you, because every one of them has an identification signature, electronically speaking.
Yeah, but do carry around your own Faraday cage.
Well, I think that, one of I came across an interoffice memo that was distributed through the Hercules Aerospace Company in Sandy, Utah, some years ago in the late 1980s. And it was making reference to this sort of quantum zero-point energy as a fundamental enabling technology. And it went through a whole list of different kinds of products that could be created using this sort of technology and the application of very fine high resolution plasma effects that could produce optical and radio frequency technologies that would permit computers to operate at billions of times the speed that was available back in the late 80s. And it's probably technology that is sort of, as you were inquiring earlier, has sort of insinuated itself into modern electronics in ways that, you know, we're not even aware.
Right.
Ways that allow everything you say on a phone or every person you talk to and their location to all be tracked very precisely. And this is why when I see things like the terrorist event at the Boston Marathon a year or two ago, and everything that's happened in the wake of that, aside from the fact that the Russians told us in advance that the Tsarnaev brothers were terrorists, and I mean, there's just no way that the government and the NSA did not know that that event was going to happen. And it's largely because of this kind of technology. You know, it's one thing to have, you know, your political opponent in the world, to tell you, look out for these guys. But then when the event happens, you find all these people, wearing camouflage uniforms, carrying backpacks with chemical, biological, and nuclear environmental suits, you know, pop out of the woodwork instantly as though they were expecting
right.
something. So to me, I just, I think that it was very clear that not only did they know that this thing was going to happen, but they were prepared for it to happen, and then they were prepared to exploit the outcome for, not only, demanding an enhancement of the budget, but also sort of condition the populace to the possibility that, on a moment's notice, you could find yourself under martial law. And those are things that I'm very concerned about.
Right.
Who really loves the country and the Constitution, everything that it stands for, and the sacrifices that so many of our military folks have made over the, last 200 years or so.
Well, that's why I think it can be invaluable if more people understand what kind of technology is available. I know in the financial realm, for many years I've had lots of people in the financial world say the dollar's going to collapse, not understanding that one of the things behind the dollar is this kind of technology. And so...
Well, yeah, I really can't speak to the economic side of things. That's really your expertise and your area of experience. But I can tell you that this kind of technology is not cheap.
Right.
Not by any means.
Right. Right. And I think if you look at Congress struggling with balancing the budget, I think part of the problem is that we're talking about an infrastructure that's very expensive, but that can't be discussed overtly.
Right.
And part of the challenge is how do you re-engineer the budget when there's huge demands for this kind of infrastructure, but it can't be openly discussed. And so to me, if we're going to rebalance the global economy, we need to kind of bring this out into the sunshine and talk about, okay,
well,
let's look at the whole budget.
But to me, it says so much more about what quantitative easing might actually be about. You just
right.
expand the money supply so you can keep spending, and everybody else can't understand why the dollar no longer has the buying power that it had, 34 years ago. I remember in 1974 traveling across country and being outraged that the price of gasoline went from 25 to 50 cents,
Oh, the good old days.
An increase, overnight. But back then, the idea of, even paying as much as $4 for the cheap stuff, these days, it just gives you a sort of a window on how the value of the dollar has been diminished so much by, printing money like there's no tomorrow.
Right. So I believe this is one of the drivers of debasement, but for another day. So, Mark, tell us how we find your website and stay current with your work.
Okay. Well, I'm on Facebook, of course, Mark McCandlish. It's McCandlish. My website is www.markmccandlish.com, no spaces. It's not case sensitive as far as I know. The website is sort of undergoing a reconstruction at the moment because my website actually got hacked by Anonymous, if you can believe that. And so I had to go back in and sort of do some repairs there. But that's ongoing. So, you know, I'm always interested in hearing about the experiences that people have had. You know, I don't laugh anymore at some of the stories that I hear that are bizarre because I think that if it's true that this technology exists and that an interstellar travel capability is really possible, then you know, it certainly opens up the possibility that some of the technology that we have now may have been borrowed from mechanical failures of vehicles that have come here from other star systems and other civilizations. And so I'm always open to hearing what people have to say about their experiences, what they've seen. And you can determine an awful lot about the technology being used by the effects that are manifest in and around these vehicles when they're in operation. So those are things I'm interested in hearing about. Also, you know, for people who sort of lament the fact that they've never had a sighting as I once did, I think most of it has to do with spending enough time out under the stars at night. I have had a few daylight sightings, but not too many, but mostly at night. And if you can get a hold of some of those thermal imaging goggles or night vision goggles, there is an even greater likelihood that you'll have a sighting of some kind. So,
yeah, that's clear from the presentations we saw. Well, Mark, I can't thank you enough for everything you've done and for being willing to discuss this publicly. It's unbelievable. I will say this, just as a looking at it from the economic and financial side, it's the piece of the puzzle that makes sense of everything. And
it does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It really does. That's one of the I enjoyed the Secret Space Program conference immensely because I felt as though, you know, what I'm saying doesn't make much sense without what you and Joseph Farrell and Richard Dolan are saying and Michael was saying, and having the asset side of the balance sheet present in strength and you know, discussing it in a way that I, you know, it's just not what I know. You know, I felt like, okay, I'm one side of the coin. Here's the other side of the coin. You know, finally, there's a big tree to lean against. That's great.
I know. And the funny thing about it, too, is that the technology is so advanced, almost to the point of appearing magical. It's very easy to ridicule someone who claims that they've seen these kinds of performance that I'm familiar with, because it seems beyond the realm of what is possible with the physics that we know of, and so that of course makes it much easier to sort of divert attention away from what's really going on, where
right.
money is going, and I mean, but one of the really odd things that I've come across recently in a correspondence I've been having with a scientist who's been involved in some of the high energy weapons development that has been ongoing is that very often there are vehicles that come down literally descending right out of space in just a few moments, and they hover near the test site where some of these high energy weapon systems are being tested. It is particularly true at White Sands, but there are other few locations in the desert of Southern California and places like that, where you know, and these tests were classified. These are tests that that no one was supposed to know about, and yet, just a few moments before the test was supposed to be initiated, a craft would come down, stop on a dime, hover, you know, within in direct line of sight of where the test was being conducted, and then immediately after the test had concluded, away it went. And you know, so you run into scientists who, you know, speak in hushed tones among themselves about what they've seen and how bizarre it was, but they're not very likely to talk, you know, in public or openly about what's been going on. But there is a very powerful undercurrent of concern on the part of many of these people by what they've seen and experienced.
Right.
You know, when you can't talk about it, either because you have a certain level of classification, you know, in your employment. Or because you're simply worried about your project being funded again next year, you know, and you don't want to sound like you're crazy. it's a great way.
Well, it's interesting. When I moved to the Heartland, you know, when I moved to Tennessee, what I found out was the general population was much more knowledgeable. And I think because there have been so many sightings by so many people, you know, everybody has either seen a craft or seen an unusual airship. You know, they don't know whether they're coming from Earth or someplace else.
I wouldn't have thought that was true.
Yeah, the Heartland is much more sophisticated about this in a lot of ways. Hmm. We're also, I live in the South, so we're much more, I'll never forget at church when somebody saying, oh, well, it must be true, the New York Times said so, and everybody laughed, because they're much more used to having lies told, you know, sort of in what's called the beat down. But, so I think so many people have seen this, or some kind of advanced aircraft that they're, I just think in the general population, there's more sophistication on this topic than people really realize. And, you know, on the East and West Coast, I find much more, unwillingness to talk about it in many populations, especially the financial population. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that, you know, if you are crunching numbers and you're looking at financial details, you're less likely to be thinking about advanced weapon technology. But, you know, I just briefly recount one story where a man and wife were on their way to work. They had a car in the shop and they were sharing transportation. And they were passing the final approach zone for a local military base. And they saw this very large, very unusual aircraft coming into the runway system, descending. It had streaming smoke from one of its engines and a lot of fire trucks and stuff waiting for it on the flight line ahead, and passed right over the freeway. And a few minutes later, after this gentleman dropped his wife off to work, came back the other way and said that all of the fire trucks and other vehicles were gathered around this one spot, and you could kind of see the shimmering outline of this aircraft, but it was, for the most part, invisible. you could see the smoke being displaced by the shape of the vehicle, that it was still there. You just couldn't see it. That really floored me. And these are people who, you know, like you're saying, are just, you know, average, everyday citizens who just are floored by the strange things that they've seen, and yet they describe it in visual terms in
right.
a way that helps me to understand clearly that they're not making this up. They really did see something.
Well, that's why I like the expression, Richard's expression, breakaway civilization, because at this point we really are looking, you know, at a series of operations in a civilization which has become separate, but we're sharing the planet with them. Mm-hmm. So,
I did an interview with the folks over in Europe on Red Ice. I think it was Henrik Palmgren's radio
program.
Right. I've known some of the people who've been peripherally involved in some of these really secret programs. And one of them involves the recruitment of individuals who have special abilities. And I'm talking about, you know, not just technical remote viewing and that sort of thing, but the people who can manipulate matter with their minds.
Right.
People who can heal at a distance or even kill at a distance.
Right.
Just by using their mind. People who can start fires with some sort of energy generated right from their hands. And it sounds like a plot line from an X-Men movie or something, but I've talked to people who've seen this firsthand. And it's pretty spooky stuff.
Right.
And my belief is that, there is some kind of a breakaway civilization, a kind of non-governmental entity that is sort of behind the scenes pulling the strings. And part of what they're looking for are the best, the brightest, the fastest, the strongest, the smartest, people who can literally anticipate movements within the market or things happening in day-to-day reality before they actually happen.
Right.
This kind of ability gives this kind of a group a strategic edge.
Advantage that's tremendous.
To see what's happening, you know, up ahead. to literally to be able to look at, ahead in time and see an assassination attempt on a government official, to be able to predict with some degree of reality how someone may vote in the future and then work to manipulate their attitude or their perspective in such a way that you change that vote in the way that you would like it to occur, you know, the outcome that you're looking for. And you know, of course, you can always sort of do a little arm twisting by saying, you feel a little tingle in your heart? Well, that's us getting ready to stop your heart if you don't vote the way we want.
Right.
That's pretty right. Scary stuff.
But, right. Yes, I know. I've bumped into them more than a few occasions, but that's a topic for another day. Anyway, Mark, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Salieri Report. It is always fascinating to listen to you, and I look forward to doing so again in the future.
Same here. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. I know the topic is probably a little unusual for the financial market and people that follow that, but I think
right now he who controls advanced technology is driving the financial markets, and that's what we need to understand.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
I think that's entirely possible.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you
okay.
for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.